There's nothing quite like risking your life for a bowl of white rice. This is Seven Samurai.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Seen and Heard.
Hi.
This is the podcast where two Hollywood assistants go through the Sight and Sound Top 100 Greatest Films of All Time list. I'm Greg Kleinschmidt.
Hi, I'm Jackie Postajian.
And we're back this week for a little-known film by a little-known filmmaker, little-seen filmmaker, really. His day will come someday.
He's the Van Gogh of movies, one might say.
It's Kurosawa's Seven Samurai from 1954. What number is this on the list?
Oh, fuck.
Shit. Oh, it's number 17.
That's what I thought. 17, Seven Samurai.
There you go. Yeah, get that seven in there. It's actually tied with Persona for number 17.
Wow.
Yes. So
that's our first tie at the top. All our ties have been from the bottom. That's interesting. So how many votes did each of them get? It says it right on the bottom.
Seven Samurai got 48 votes.
Then that means Persona got the same.
And Persona also got 48, yes.
Oh my God, Persona and Seven Samurai back to back tied?
Yeah, that's kind of cool. That's kind of really cool. Yeah. Just a quick little note. Last week we did do Altman's Nashville. I said something during that episode that I just want to like smooth over. I at one point said that Grand Hotel and Dinner at Eight were comedies. I kind of like dismissed them. I was like, yeah, ensemble movies existed in the 30s, but they were comedies. Those aren't necessarily. They're more dramatic. Honestly, I don't really know what I was thinking in that moment. I kind of like knew better, but I said it anyway.
Listen, I had a similar slip last episode and I'm very ashamed. And when you sent it to me, I even sent you, I texted you immediately when I heard it. I'm like, oh my God, I said that, which is completely false. I was talking about the comparisons between Inside Llewyn Davis and Nashville, two movies I adore and whose soundtracks I have memorized. And I, for some reason, said that both the music in both movies was written for the films. It was not, obviously, for Inside Llewyn Davis. Those are folk songs. I think I was just like, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know what I was thinking. I think it's just the fact that it's such a produced album and I listen to it all the time. I just like thought of that, but
no, it makes sense. I would have, when you said it, I didn't clock that it was wrong. So even though I also knew better.
But see, doesn't this make you nervous?
No.
Like, what else have I said?
Here's the thing. We make mistakes sometimes. It's just part of the process.
I guess.
You know what I want to say right now?
What?
Disneyland. Because it's going to happen every episode. There, I just got out of the way.
Let's get it out of the way. Yeah. How can we compare Seven Samurai to Disneyland? Oh, Bug's Life. That's it. Yeah. There we go.
R.I.P. Bug's Land and California Adventure.
There you go.
What were they thinking?
There you go. That was our Disneyland reference. Bye, everyone.
Yeah. anyway, Jackie, what have you been watching this last week?
So I'm here to report to the people of the podcast that I saw Moulin Rouge, the musical. I saw it the last week. It was here at the Pantages. And Katya's going to kill me for this, but I'm a Moulin Rouge the movie person, and there are so many people out there that are Moulin Rouge the musical people, which is totally fine, but I am, to my core, a Moulin Rouge the movie person. I'm not comparing the two. I'm just saying if you love one of them so much, I don't think it's really possible to love the other one. And it's the same for my friend who is obsessed with it. She doesn't really like the movie that much, but she is obsessed with the show. And it's just this like this weird dissonance, you know? But it's like, it was good. Don't get me wrong. It was a really, really, really fun time. Like, it was a blast. I felt marvelous while I was there. A little too marvelous. Like, it's so sterile. It's really like a sterile kind of PG Moulin Rouge.
PG? How is it PG?
Just everything that's like kind of serious is totally glossed over. And, you know, I was wondering before I went in how they were going to handle the whole like Satine coughing and like dying, essentially. Because in the movie, it's like, you know, it's these really dramatic, like gasping for air, and in the show it's just kind of like she dies in the end and it's extremely underwhelming, like so underwhelming, and then they all start can-canning and I'm like, oh cool, like woo, and I was dancing, and I mean it was fun. I just feel like it's kind of a Moulin Rouge for like 2000s, like my age people, I guess, or maybe a little younger. I mean, I don't want to sound pretentious or anything, but it's kind of for like, I feel like it's kind of for teenagers.
I think
my mom loved it though.
Bass has lost his touch, I think.
No, it's not bad. Trust me. Like, it's a really fun night of theater. And they added, some of the song choices that they added are like really not good, but some of them were really good and really fun. Besides that, what did I watch? Oh my God. I watched The Children's Hour with Shirley MacLaine and Audrey Hepburn. Greg, run. Don't walk. You are going to love it. It blows any Cirque movie I've seen out of the water. I'm sorry.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like good melodrama. Like really good. It was so... These girls are unhinged. These little girls... Do you know what it's about?
Not really.
Okay, so Shirley MacLaine and Audrey Hepburn are like college best friends and they open a girls' school. I think it's in upstate New York, or maybe it's like, I don't know. They don't specify. I don't know why. In like movies from the 50s and 60s, anytime it's like a small town, I just assume upstate New York. I don't know why. So they have this one like really bratty student, and she's evil. She makes Regina George look like a saint. She is dark, this girl. And she hates them and they hate her because she's a bitch, obviously. And she, in order to not go to school anymore, tells her grandma, who's this very rich lady, that they're lesbians. And the school gets shut down and their lives are ruined. And it is really good.
Wow, that sounds great.
Loud. Like, I was watching it here right now. We're in my basement where I watch movies. And I was worried my mom could hear, like, upstairs. I even, like, texted her. I'm like, is it too loud? Because they're screaming. These little girls, I'm telling you, like, vicious. It's a delicious, wicked, but also really sad movie. I think you'd like it.
It's been on my list for a long time. Yeah.
No joke. It has been on my list for 10 years. I'm not even joking. So I literally just sat my ass down. I'm like, I'm watching Children's Hour today.
Sounds like I need to do that.
It's really good. You'd really like it. I feel like I've talked forever, so that's it for me.
I just saw two. I was in Mexico, so I saw Cat People, the Paul Schrader Cat People with Nastassja Kinski. And it was okay. Actually, I'd been meaning to see this for a long time because I love the David Bowie song that he did for the film. And it's Paul Schrader and it's Nastassja Kinski, who I love, and Malcolm McDowell is in it. And I've seen the original one from the 40s, which I'm not really a big fan of, just about people that turn into cats. This one, though.
But isn't that your dream?
Because, yes. No, not at all. But this one, because it's Paul Schrader, they turn into cats when they're like sexually aroused.
That's so funny.
And there's this weird incest thing between her and Malcolm McDowell because they're like brother and sister. Ooh. It's a little like, yeah, I don't know. It was not crazy enough for me. It actually played it like a little too straight. Like I wanted it to go wild and it didn't go that wild. And then I saw, so for the film club, we did Abbas Kiarostami's final film that I think he actually was completed after he died, called 24 Frames. And it's just a series of 24 photos. It starts with a piece of art and then the other 23 are just like pictures he took, and he just like digitally animates them to try to represent what happened in the frame before and after the photo was taken. So
cool.
Most of it, it's like birds are kind of flying. Sometimes you'll hear like opera like coming in from another room and you'll hear the wind blowing through the trees. I love that kind of stuff. This is literally 2 hours of that. Yeah, I liked it. I had some problems with it. It looked a little kind of digital, I think, again, because it was completed after he died. One thing I want to say about it, though, is the final frame, the frame 24, has a song in it that I was not expecting. And as soon as I heard it, it made me love. Like, I really dug the movie. But when I heard that song, I like fell in love. He plays Andrew Lloyd Webber's Love Never Dies. Now, for those who don't know, Love Never Dies is the sequel. It's the musical sequel to Phantom of the Opera from 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was a huge bomb. And I think most Phantom fans don't really like it.
I've never seen it, I listened to the music, but I read the plot on Wikipedia and it sounds god awful.
It's, you know what? It was all right. I had free tickets, so I went like 5 years ago. And I don't regret going, but.
But it ruins it.
Most of them.
Doesn't it ruin it?
I mean, you know, things happen that are a little crazy.
It's awful.
It all takes place at Coney Island.
It's horrible. Yeah, Meg is like a murderer.
But the title song, Love Never Dies. Yeah. Have you heard that?
No.
It's beautiful.
I've avoided this musical at all costs.
Just listen to that song. Because like if that was in the Phantom soundtrack, it would be one of the best songs. It's a beautiful song. And it pops up in this Kiarostami movie.
That's so funny.
And it closes the film. Like the film rolls over, like the credits roll over this Love Never Dies.
Wow.
And I was just like bowled over at like the audacity of using this like failed Phantom sequels
That's
title
hilarious.
Song. Anyway, should we get into this week's film?
No.
Please, no.
All right, fine.
Spoiler alert, she hated it.
No, I love this movie.
Just kidding.
Okay, fine, let's do it.
From 1954, this is Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai.
Seven Samurai is a Japanese film from 1954. It was directed by Akira Kurosawa, co-written by Kurosawa, Shinobu Hashimoto, and Hideo Oguni. Fun fact, Kurosawa also served as the editor on the film. Did you know that?
I didn't.
Really? I'm surprised. And cinematography is by Asakazu Nakai. The film tells the epic story of a group of farmers in 16th century feudal Japan who employ the help of seven samurai warriors to protect their village from bandits who steal their crop and ransack their town. Their only means of paying the samurai? Bowls upon bowls of white rice. The group of samurai are led by the wise ronin Kanbei. Among other notables in the group, the hot-headed Kikuchiyo, himself the son of farmers, posing as a samurai, Kyozo, the quiet badass, and the young rookie, Katsushiro, who falls in love with and kind of, or like not really falls in love with, has a thing with one of the village girls, Shino, much to the chagrin of her father. The skilled samurai train the farmers to fight with bamboo spears and create fortifications in the town. Eventually, the bandits come and the battle commences. The village is victorious, however, four of the samurai are slain, and the remaining three heroes mourn their loss while the farmers celebrate and plant more crops. The film stars Toshiro Mifune as Kikuchiyo, Takashi Shimura as Kanbei, and Yoshio Tsuchiya as Farmer Rikichi. The set for the film was constructed after Kurosawa refused to shoot at the Toho Studios. It went way over budget. Production was shut down at least twice, apparently. And he was super chill about it because he was like, you guys have put this much money into it. You're going to let me finish it. Kurosawa had a method of editing at nights during production on his films. So he loved editing. He thought it was the most exciting part and the most important aspect of filmmaking. So yeah, he would literally edit his movies at night while he was shooting them. Like, that is crazy. Do you ever like hear about people who work at night and you're just like, how?
It blows my mind because, yeah, you want to go home and go to sleep to rest up for the next day.
And it almost makes me feel like I'm doing something wrong.
No, everybody has their own working
style. Are you sure? Another cool thing about this movie is that it was shot with multiple cameras. The film was released in the U.S. as The Magnificent Seven, and 50 minutes of the film were cut out for American audiences. The title of the film was then changed back to Seven Samurai in 1960 when a Western remake of the film called The Magnificent Seven was released. Seven Samurai was nominated for two Oscars, Best Art Direction and Best Costume Design. I love that, like, I just can't believe that there's been a remake of the remake of this movie.
Yeah. You mean Bug's Life?
That and The Magnificent Seven from like 2016.
Oh, right, right. A remake of the remake. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Confession, I've never seen the original Magnificent Seven.
I've never seen it.
You know why?
I don't care.
I saw this first.
Here.
Yeah, where are you from?
I don't care.
Cab driver. No, I think, yeah, I just... I have this weird thing about Remix, and tell me if you're the same way. So, for example, I saw, in the opposite direction, I saw Fistful of Dollars first, the Sergio Leone film, which is the first film in Leone's Dollars trilogy. And that's like a blatant remake of Yojimbo. In fact, he didn't even ask Kurosawa for the rights. He just like made the movie, and it's pretty much beat for beat Yojimbo. So I saw Fistful of Dollars first. And then I went back later and saw Yojimbo and actually didn't have much patience for it. And again, it's not the movie's fault because Yojimbo is the original.
Yeah.
But I was like, I know exactly what's going to happen next. I have this weird thing with remakes. If the remake is too close, of just starting to like tune out.
Wow.
So like, I know that if I watch Magnificent Seven, I know it has this great theme and whatever. It has this great all-star cast. But like, I know the beats. And
exactly.
How can you top Seven Samurai? So I've never seen it.
I've never seen it.
Yeah, confession time.
Do you want to see it?
No, I just said no.
Well, yeah, I guess you did.
You know what? That. Never. No, I'm just kidding. I'll see it at some point.
If you ever do, I will find you and I'll remind you. I will
like, listen,
clip.
You said you were never going to watch this movie.
What are your initial thoughts?
So in high school, this was a big deal. So
for a film bro, yes.
I don't want to like make myself sound too important here, but our high school, we were lucky in that we had like a film program. It was like film mixed with English. So instead of just taking regular English all year, you'd have like, it was called media or studio. And it was essentially you'd get your English class, but it was mixed with film and filmmaking. So it was a really cool combination. For example, an assignment we had was to like make a script out of like a chapter of Huck Finn or something.
Wow.
So that was my sophomore, junior and senior years was studio.
What?
Yeah. So at that time, I was watching a lot of stuff that my friends weren't watching. Like, I showed them Fellini. I showed them I still remember my friends telling me that The Godfather was boring. I'm like, you need to watch it again right now and you need to shut the fuck up. And of course, they did watch it again. They're like, yeah, we were wrong. Mm-hmm. But the one thing at that age that I could not get into was like samurai movies. For some weird reason, I just couldn't get into them. And so I remember all my friends were into Seven Samurai because this is like, you know, this is the first stop on a journey of like Japanese cinema, samurai cinema, you know, even if martial arts, even though it's technically is not martial arts, like this is kind of like a first stop on that journey. And so all my friends were raving about Seven Samurai and I saw it was like a 3.5 hour long movie. And so I didn't watch it. And it kind of had this like bad taste in my mouth. And then finally, I think like senior year, I like forced myself to watch it and I didn't really dig it. Fast forward, maybe now I'm like out of high school for 5 to 8 years, something like that. I saw it again and I was like, I was a fool. And I thought it was incredible and I was completely blown away by it. And I've seen it in a handful of times since then, including to prep for this episode. And yeah, it's a masterpiece. I mean, I'm a big Kurosawa fan. It's funny because Kurosawa is your first stop in Japanese cinema because he's the most famous Japanese director, probably next to like Hayao Miyazaki, again, making a completely different type of films. But I think what makes Kurosawa so accessible is that his films feel very, like they're very tailored for a Western audience. I think that's just, and he's been accused of that before, but I think that's just like the kinds of stories he wants to tell just kind of fit in. Like they are these like proto-Westerns and stuff.
Yeah.
And he kind of gets lost in the shuffle because the big three of this era, it's Kurosawa, you have Ozu, and you have Mizoguchi. Ozu and Mizoguchi are so much more like Japanese. Mm-hmm. Like their whole aesthetic and their whole the stories they're telling are very, very Japanese. Where Kurosawa's films are big spectacles, adventure films, fighting. And so where was I going with this thought? So he kind of gets like some shade for that. But it's important. Again, I think maybe at one point I thought that too. And I was like, oh, Kurosawa, like you have Ozu and Mizoguchi. Who needs Kurosawa? I stupidly thought that. And then you come back around. You're like, I was an idiot. Kurosawa is a god. And this film is amazing. I think what's so great about this movie is that it's a very simple story. The movie immediately gets into the story. Like immediately, like the first shot is bandits riding to the mm-hmm, town. Mm-hmm. It wastes no time. And what I love about the movie is it's a 3 hour and 20 minute movie and there's like no fat on it. Like there's nothing, if they handed me a pair of scissors, let's just say I wasn't going to get crucified by the entire film community for doing this. They handed me a pair of scissors like, Greg, you need to cut out 5 minutes. I'm like, I can't do it. Because yeah. I really think everything here is super essential. Mm-hmm. And what I love about the movie is that how patient it is with while it still keeps a really nice pace and how the movie just doles out character stuff and it just like builds in this really organic, beautiful way. And again, the movie is so like painstaking in its like preparation for this battle, for this confrontation. Like, I love all those map shots and you get a good layout of like the village. Okay, here's the bridge at the south. North are the mountains. Yeah. Are the mountains passable? Yes, they are. And so like you really get to know this village and the people in it. And I think it just increases the stakes that much more. Mm-hmm. But I love the films that really put in the work of like all the little things they do, like we're going to flood these fields and then we're going to do this, like all this logistical stuff that other movies would kind of like gloss over. Kurosawa takes the time to like really put the work in and it invests you more in the movie because you see every step that they put into this. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a masterpiece. I think it's a masterpiece, honestly, like in adventure action filmmaking. Yes. Like it's not so much this profound masterpiece, you know, it's not Seventh Seal. It's mm-hmm. not, and I think Kurosawa does have some more meaningful movies. You know, there's like Ikiru, or like mm-hmm. I love High and Low. High and Low might be my favorite Kurosawa movie. But this movie, again, it's not concerned with being realistic. It's pretty much a bloodless movie. He's more concerned with myth and sort of like spectacle. And ultimately, you see, I mean, obviously, like Spielberg and George Lucas and stuff were huge Kurosawa fans, and you can see the DNA of this through all of their work.
Yes.
But also I saw a lot of Peter Jackson in this, you know, like in terms of like, look at the Lord of the Rings movies in terms of like the battle for Helm's Deep or something and the preparation for battles and the sort of the ebb and flow of the story. So yeah, I mean, this is just so staggeringly influential that it's like even really hard to talk about. But I think what's so cool about Seven Samurai is it's so unpretentious, especially for a 3.5 hour movie. Like, it's not this super philosophical. The thing is, there's depth to it, right? And the characters are all there and like you can read into it, but you can also enjoy it from a surface level because it's a really engaging story. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think it's a masterpiece. It's not a masterpiece in the same way that I would think like Seventh Seal is or something that's a little bit more, I don't want to say meaty because that sounds demeaning towards the movie. And I'm not saying
You know what it is? What? This is a perfect movie.
It is a perfect movie.
Like in the way that you're saying, it's a perfectly crafted, structured adventure movie.
Yeah.
And it is the fiber of everything we've seen since.
Right.
And I didn't realize it like as much until this time around, I think. I've only seen it twice.
Your first time was just a couple months ago.
Yeah, right? And it was on the podcast. Those were my initial thoughts. I was like, oh, Bug's Life, cool. And then when I watched it right now, I was like, oh. I just sat back and enjoyed the ride because the first time I watched it, I feel like I was kind of trying to understand the world. What's so amazing about it, and you kind of touched on this, is that it is this like such an old world. 1500s? Are you kidding me? It's so like the world is so foreign to us. I mean, us being like in the one being in Americans, and two, the fact that it's in the 15th century, and yet, oh my God, it's just. It has so much humor and heart and feeling and emotion. Like, you don't feel like you're in this different world at all after a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, people credit Jaws as being, like, the catalyst for the blockbuster.
I think this is...
No, I'm saying... I mean, obviously, Jaws was commercially and culturally where this wasn't necessarily at the time. But yeah, I mean, exactly. Like, this is doing what Jaws did. You know, it's like the same kind of filmmaking.
So like, we'll talk about this a little more, I think. But like, this is the start of the trope of just like gathering people for a mission. I mean, that's all over, like, I hate to say, but like Marvel and Avengers and everything. Like, even like the Ocean's movies, kind of. And then just this like this formula of having this action movie where like the dialogue is really witty and the characters are all different. I mean, it's this. And you know what else I love about it, though? For being an action movie set in this really dark time in medieval Japan, the number of bad things that happen are relatively minimal.
It's true.
It's kind of a nice movie until like the last hour.
Have you seen the Mizoguchi movie Sancho the Bailiff?
No.
That's like, again,
really dark.
Yeah. That's again, the difference between Mizoguchi and Kurosawa. Like, that's very dark and tragic.
Yeah,
and
because look at Seventh Seal. How many bad things happen in that also at the same time? But in this movie, it's kind of just like, yeah, we're learning how to fight, and then we're gonna fight, and yeah, we're gonna lose some guys, but life goes on. It's very interesting. Yeah, I have this list of movies that are period pieces that I love because they just feel like incredibly real and incredibly lived in. And it's in like the little things, like the way people interact with each other. Sometimes it's in the inflections of their voice. Obviously, in this movie, they're speaking in like pretty modern vernacular. So I think that this is like the proto period piece of the period pieces I then love now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like, it might be dangerous to call this like the first sort of like period epic.
No, I'm not calling it the first period epic. I'm calling it the first period piece that feels really like lived in and like these are real people.
I mean, what about like Joan of Arc?
That doesn't feel like real people.
That's true. No, it doesn't.
What else? Throw another one on me. Seventh Seal does.
Well, Seventh Seal was a few years after this.
Was it?
Yeah.
I don't mean like the proto one. Just like it was interesting to me that I thought of my list while I was watching this.
Yeah. Again, it's simple because it all takes place in this one village.
Yeah.
And again, the scale is small.
Yeah.
And that's really like key because you can do... You get
emotional
all,
stuff.
You can do emotional stuff and you get all that detail.
Yeah, like we know who's detail. Related to who. We know that there's an old man who doesn't want to leave his house. And
yeah,
definitely. Let's talk about the historical context a little bit, though, because I did like the first time I watched it. I mean, I didn't know what these civil wars were. I didn't really understand the part where they bring all the samurai gear of the samurais the farmers have killed. I was like, wait, what? I thought these guys were like weakly things. So what happened basically in medieval Japan, emperors were powerless and it was basically like the kingdom was run by shoguns, which were just like military leaders and it was hereditary. So in 1500s, though, there was a civil war amongst the warlords and the warlords' armies consisted of samurai, this class of people who were trained, who were rich, one, and were of a higher class than regular commoners, obviously. And obviously they're samurai, they're like warriors. So, but what happened was when one of the warlords lost, their samurais would just be like on the loose and some would become ronins, which are just like samurai for hire, which are what all the samurais in this movie are. Or they would like band together and become bandits because they were so strong and they knew how to fight. They would just steal shit. So like the bandits are really ex-samurai. I didn't realize that until this time around.
Mm-hmm. They've just turned to the dark side.
Exactly. And of course, that adds so many layers. That whole scene is so... I mean, we'll talk later about the scene and what it has to do with the characters, but the scene where they discover the samurai's clothing and they're so offended, like, so powerful. But
I just want to talk about that quickly, is what I love about that is that they use it... He uses it as a moment to dive into Mifune's character.
Of course.
And, like, I think in a lesser film, it would just be like, oh, look at this armor we found. And then that would kind of be it.
Yes.
But again, it ties so beautifully into him.
Of course.
And also it gives the village more depth too.
Yeah, they've killed people.
Yeah, so it's like it's simple stuff like that that just adds so much.
But what I love about this movie and why I think it resonates, and we've talked about this a little bit when you said he kind of made these movies to really resonate universally, is that Kurosawa said he didn't want to make a dull movie that's steeped in tradition. Instead, he made something very human. Like he said, he had a problem with they're called Jidai Geki period pieces, which were just these Japanese movies about this same time that were very like dull. I mean, not, I haven't seen any, but he was saying like they're very slow and, you know, they're in that vein. So what he did was he subverted a genre with this movie and these norms of like honor and tradition. There's this great, great essay by Philip Kemp where he talks about this and how basically like, okay, Kanbe, the leader, has his top knot cut off in the beginning of the movie. And that's like a huge no-no. That's like, oh, a samurai would never do that. That's like going against everything they believe in. because that's kind of their badge of honor, their top knot. There's another movie where they don't kill the samurai, they just cut off their top knot, and that's enough to shame them so much that they kill themselves.
Oh, I think it's Harakiri.
Yes. Yeah. But like in this movie, it's just like, yeah, I'm going to chop off my top knot and I'm going to go save this kid. And it's so good. And of course, all of the characters have this quality of them. This like
anything can
anti-tradition
happen.
Or I'm kind of an underdog. Like they say all the time about how one of them says how he ran away or, oh, we lost that battle. Like they always talk about losing. And even in the end, it's really sad. Like they haven't won. They even say they're like, oh, the farmers won. We didn't win. There's no traces of this like blind loyalty and honor and these really like toxic masculine things, you know? And it's really great. And of course, the humor is a big part of that.
Yeah.
The humor. This movie's funny.
Yeah. Most of it comes from Mifune, but who's the leader again? What's his name?
Kanbe.
Yeah, he's great too. He's super funny.
And the ending.
They're all just like cracking jokes.
Yeah. The ending, though, is a shit show. Like one of them is sobbing. Kikuchiyo is lying face down in shit and rain. Like, it's not this glorious samurai's triumphant over these bandits. It's just so interesting that it's so layered. It's what makes it so charming.
It's the toll that it takes on everybody.
Yeah.
It gives it some weight.
Yeah.
Even though it is a fantasy. Like, this, nothing about this is, like, grounded, really.
Right.
This is fantasy. It is escapism, right? Like, yes. This is escapism, without a doubt. This is the adventure film. This is the action film. But there's just enough weight to it. Things are just shitty enough, and things are just heavy enough to, like, affect you.
Of course. And going back to the humor, I just want to talk about some of my favorite jokes in this movie. How about when Mifune, like, slaps his ass in front of the bandits?
He's, like, wearing a thong for all of this movie.
What about when he imitates the farmers?
Oh, so good.
It's so good.
And him talking to the kids, like, he's so good with kids.
I know. To the horse, when the horse, like, kicks him off, he goes, please stop, I apologize. And then, oh my god, I love when the young one is, like, in the field, and he just lays down, and then Kanbe's like, told you guys, like, he's a kid.
Yeah.
You know, when he's laying down in the flowers, and then he sees the girl, Shino, and he thinks that she's a boy.
Yeah.
Because he's dumb.
Well, she tells him that, yeah.
Okay. And he goes, oh, this is no time for an able-bodied boy to be picking flowers. And then, like, he has flowers in his hand, and he's like, oh, like, it's so good.
Yeah, no. I mean, really, it's like, Kurosawa was great with that. Just, like, keeping it light enough. It's just light enough, again, for, like, a big audience, which is why this movie has resonated so much over the years.
Let's talk about the movies that influenced this movie, and then the movies that it then influenced.
Well, the movies that it influenced are just immeasurable, yes.
But here's what Kurosawa said about Westerns. He said, good Westerns are liked by everyone. Since humans are weak, they want to see good people and great heroes. Westerns have been done over and over again, and in the process, a kind of grammar has evolved. I have learned from this grammar of the Western.
Yeah, you can tell he's a big John Ford fan.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I mean, what he's describing, and I don't want to say it again, but what he's describing is now superhero movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so weird because it's like, I won't. It's just funny because it was like, okay, there were Westerns and then there were samurai movies. And then there were more Westerns that were then influenced by the samurai movies. And it's all just this big jumble of like good guys, bad guys, heroes, action. Like,
yeah.
Well, the samurai movie lives in
itself. It's Japan's Westerns. Yeah, that's it. And again, like, because we have done a couple Westerns on the show, including one kind of more classic Western in The Searchers, and then we did The Wild Bunch, which is supposedly more radical, which we didn't necessarily agree with. But you could say that Kurosawa kind of like pushed the Western forward a lot, like obviously as immediate as like the remake Magnificent Seven, but also like the spaghetti Western too. Yeah. Like you can kind of see a lot of the swagger of like Seven Samurai, and especially like the Mifune character, is kind of like the birth of the spaghetti Western, because it would kind of take that, like Sergio Leone
like
and all those guys.
Hot-headed.
Yeah, they would take it and kind of like anti-hero. Push it further and further and further and stylize it more and more and more.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Mifune really quick.
Let's talk about it.
This was not his first collaboration with Kurosawa. Obviously, Mifune is one of the, I mean, if you were to make a list of like the top two or three most famous Japanese actors, he might be number one.
And can I just say, I hadn't seen him in anything but like period garb, so I decided to just Google him. Oh my god.
Yeah.
He is
a handsome man.
A beautiful man. He was truly a beautiful man. I had no idea. I'm like, wait, this guy lived in the 50s and 60s. I don't even know what he looked like. Yeah. And I looked him up and I was just like, hello.
Yeah.
So yeah, I just want to point that out there for anyone interested. Look him up. Not in period clothing.
I think his performance here is kind of groundbreaking in the way that almost like, he's almost like the Japanese Brando, or
he has ADD for sure in this movie. His character has ADD.
Or James Dean.
Yeah.
There's a physicality to him. It's almost like a feral performance.
Yeah. Which he never stops moving. He's pacing like the entire movie.
Yeah, and he's moving around kind of like an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you can see this as recently as Joaquin Phoenix. A lot of Joaquin Phoenix's roles, especially like in The Master.
Yes.
Very much that feral animalistic type of thing. But at the time, 1954, especially coming out of Japan, like that's a pretty, that is crazy. A very modern performance. It's like that is a very,
so modern.
It's a very
lived in.
It's lived in and it's very big while mm-hmm. not going like off the tracks.
It goes pretty off the tracks, but not in a bad way.
But in a believable way. Yeah. In the context of the story. Like,
yes. And his monologue during the samurai armor scene. Amazing.
Beautiful.
And here's the thing, like, I love the way that it's just like, I think all monologues should be shot like that. And then I thought about it and I'm like, wait, is this like similar to Eyes Wide Shut or am I tripping? Like Nicole Kidman's monologue, because I love that monologue too. So then I looked it up, her monologue.
No, I know, but I'm just trying to.
Oh, that's your judgmental face. Okay. I don't judge. I just decided to look it up to watch, to compare, because I'm like, I love this very close, you know, not cutting that much. Like, I'm like, this is the way monologues should be. And then I thought of that monologue and I looked it up and it's like, it's not that different. But like, the thing is, Mifune is moving around the whole time. Like, he is moving, moving, moving. The camera's following him. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay.
Relax. I was just saying. And Kanbei has tears in his eyes.
Yeah. No, it's beautiful.
It's so beautiful. When he says this baby is me, I cry.
You know what?
Don't say anything.
I'm going to be completely honest.
Shut up.
I almost didn't want that last line. Because,
shut up.
Because that's what he's been saying that whole time. And I feel like him saying this baby is me like puts too neat of a button on that speech.
It's not in the speech. It's later when he's holding the baby.
Let's. You know what? I want to talk about that really quick. That
jerk.
Image. Actually, no. We're going to talk about that scene later, if you know what I mean.
No, but what? It's he rescues the baby and then
you start crying. Him.
Yes, I cry at that part.
Really?
I get chills and I cry.
Wow.
He's amazing.
No, he is. He's incredible.
Yeah. I'm getting emotional.
I feel like you're
right
judging
now.
Me. Oh, you're just getting emotional. You're like, how dare you?
Do you think that the rest of the samurais, like, and here's the thing, of course, the stakes are highest for his character because he was a farmer previously. Like, and it's just so ironic that the person who looks like he's having the most fun and is just there for the ride is actually the one that's the most emotionally invested in this mission.
Yeah, he's the one with the most pain.
And it's so, just so ironic and beautiful.
Yeah. I mean, he literally forces himself into the group. They don't want him. He's not a real samurai.
Yeah.
But he's like, no, he won't take no for an answer.
I love it.
Like a feral dog who just follows them along that path.
Of course, he has the great moment with the flag where he runs and brings it.
That doesn't happen. I'm sorry.
I thought you were going to say that does nothing for me.
Oh, no, it does. You know what scene I love is in the beginning when we're introduced by, sorry, I keep forgetting the leader's name.
Kanbei.
First of all, Jesus Christ, this man is great. What a kind soul.
I love him.
Because without him, none of this would have happened. He's the one that rallies all the other samurai.
Yeah.
But I love when, he cuts off his top knot to go save the baby from this thief that's in this house, in this hut. And the guy comes out. Of course, he charges in. The guy comes out and he's about to die. He falls over and the baby's like crying and the parents come over and grab the baby. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me of like in The Godfather when like Vito gets gunned down. Like there's a certain kind of like, I think it's, a lot of mob movies.
The slow-mo like dying?
Well, not the slow-mo, but the baby crying in the background.
Oh.
There's something about a baby crying
something
horrible is happening.
Yes, but you know what's funny in this movie I noticed? They mentioned that the kid is 7 years old and he's crying like a 7-month-old.
They say 7 years old?
Yes. Oh. And the sound of the baby crying, it cannot be older than 1 year old.
Oh, shit. Wow.
I hate to ruin maybe that moment for you.
It could be a translation issue.
Could be. No, he looks big. I think they take him out of the hut. I think he looks pretty big.
It could be.
I just want to mention another samurai I love, Gorobei, who is the one that like doesn't get offended that he's trying to test him.
Oh yeah, he's great.
I love him. He's like talking to kids before they grab him, and that's how you know he's gonna be cool, right? And of course it all goes back to that thing that I was saying. It's like this movie is anti these like ideas of pride, and like, and he's just such a good example. He's just a normal dude, sweet guy, playing with kids, doesn't get offended.
Yeah.
Love him.
Yeah, there's a, I do love the way that Kurosawa does kind of like, I don't know how hard he is trying to like buck these traditions, that he's just kind of subverting them. I don't know if that's just because his personality is coming through and it's just like he's not trying to like set out to be like, I don't want to do this way. But it's just, yeah, I mean, it works like really well. And again, I think with someone like Kurosawa, the most important thing in a film is just like the entertainment value.
Yeah.
And like keeping the story flowing. And if that means making, you know, I don't know, to his credit, you know?
Yeah. He just made a movie for people. Like,
yeah, this is for the people.
The people. It really is.
Like, this is not, even though this is considered like part of the big art house boom of the 50s, this isn't some, you know, heady art house film.
Can we just talk about also, I feel like this movie doesn't shy away from like female perspective. Shino breaks my heart.
Yeah, I mean, she's the only woman that we get to really know.
Yes, there's also Rikichi's wife. So, like, okay.
Right, what's the story
can
there?
Okay, first let's talk about Shino.
Yeah.
How do you like the part where she's, like, literally she calls him, she says, coward, act like a samurai. So she's having this thing with the young one. I think his name is Katsushiro. And they're in like the grass and she just throws herself down on the grass like, and she yells at him saying like, come on, like and it's so interesting because like, you don't know if she really loves him or if she's kind of just trying to like
lust.
She could either really love him, lust, or she wants to not be a farmer anymore. She wants to marry a samurai, which some women did. Like some, like men couldn't really marry outside of their class, but some women, you know, caught the eye of someone who was higher class and they moved up. So she's just such a comp, like, that scene floors me. Like when she's, and then she starts laughing, like she's kind of like manic. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy great for scene. 1954.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so Rikichi's wife. So she was taken by bandits and she kind of became a concubine. Then there's that great moment where they start the fire, right? They want to burn out the bandits.
What a stunning scene. She comes out.
She stands
in the doorway.
Before that, she looks at the fire and she doesn't wake any of them up.
Yeah. Yeah.
She's really like, I love the way that, yes, there are only two women, like really fully fledged out women. But in both situations, I think he really makes a point to show how hard it was to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's great.
Yeah.
Like, she is complicated. Rikichi's wife is only in it for 5 minutes and she's complicated. Did she want to go with them willingly? Probably not. Even though the first time I watched it, I don't know why, I thought she did. I thought she ran away from him.
Mm-hmm.
But this time watching it, and I noticed that scene where she lets the fire start and I'm like, oh shit, she's not like with these guys. And then she kills herself because she's so ashamed.
Yeah.
Like, what? That's crazy.
It's a really devastating scene.
So devastating.
Yeah.
And then he even says it at the end when Shino and the samurai are caught. He yells at Shino's dad and he says, like, at least she wasn't taken by bandits. Like, what's wrong with two people loving each other? So good.
Yeah. I love that whole sequence where they go to the bandits' fort and stuff, because I think what's so cool about this movie is You could play this, like, the whole time they're planning, they don't want the bandits to know that the samurai are in the village. That's the whole thing. It's like, keeping quiet. Here are the scouts coming. We're going to keep quiet. They're not going to know they're here, so that when they all come, then they can ambush them. But of course, it doesn't go to plan because Toshiro Mifune makes himself known. The bandits see them. They rush off. So they're like forced to do what. Basically, what I'm saying is, I like how it's not so clean, where like their plan goes exactly according to plan, like in terms of like, they are quiet and they're not noticed, and then they come and they just have this big showdown. It is like this, oh shit, they saw us, now we got to go find their fort and let's kill them. Yeah. And now the remaining ones are coming back to us in waves.
Yeah,
that's so cool. It's not the just waves. One big battle, it's waves. Yeah. Of them,
and it lasts a few days. And
lasts a few days.
That's like similar to so many other movies. I feel like, isn't there like a Lord of the Rings battle that's similar?
For sure. Well, Helm's Deep in Two Towers is like
one night.
It's one rainy night.
Yeah, rain again in this movie. It's like, and that is the climactic night. Like everyone's like, get some sleep. You can visit your families, and like, it's all so classic.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Maybe in Lord of the Rings. I mean, in Return of the King, there's that big battle for Middle Earth at the end with like those elephants and stuff. But I think that might
it's like
be,
one day.
Yeah, maybe it's a couple. I don't know.
Game of Thrones. Oh my God.
Yeah. I think, too, what I like about it is Kurosawa, because there's so much happening in this movie, there's so many moving gears. You have so many characters. You have our samurai, you have the villagers, so you have to kind of keep them apart. Then you have the bandits, mm-hmm. and there are scenes where it's raining, mm-hmm. and there's mud, and there's horses, and the visual grammar of the film is so strong that you're never lost. Mm-mm. And I think what's so cool about it is, like, it's so simple as this, and I wish for more filmmakers would do this. Them having the tally of like, there's 30 bandits and we're going to cross them off, mm-hmm. so that you see how many bandits are left after each battle. Like, okay, there's this many more left to go. Almost like a video game or something. What's cool about it is it's checking in with the audience to let you know exactly where you stand. And it's just cool because you feel like you're now more a part of it.
I love when movies do that. I feel like a few movies do that sometimes, and I always like it.
I think sometimes filmmakers think that they're above doing stuff like that. When I really appreciate it, Christopher Nolan, in terms of just like, oh no, I'm going to be like as obscure as possible in terms of like what's happening with this really confusing plot. Like the bigger the plot, the more you need to, I don't want to say hold the audience's hand, but like you have to like provide those visual signposts to like let people know where they are, what's going on.
Yeah.
It's just important because if a film loses an audience, like, okay, I didn't see Christopher Nolan's new movie Tenet. I know a couple people rave that it's a masterpiece. Most people I've talked to say that it's really bad. And it's like all of his worst tendencies in one movie. But Christopher Nolan has a reputation for having these really complicated plots and just kind of throwing you in. And I think maybe some people get off on the fact that they have to watch this movie like 10 times before they understand what the fuck is going on. But I think there's much more power in the Kurosawa approach of being like, look, I'm going to make sure you know what's happening right now. Yeah. And it's not in like a demeaning way. He's not talking down to you. He doesn't think we're dumb, but like, he's just providing the, like, this is what's happening. I think it's really important. And I honestly think in today's day and age, more filmmakers study this Kurosawa style.
Yeah.
Because again, there's no point in Seven Samurai that you don't know who you're with, what's happening right now, what they're planning to do next. Yeah. It's all so clear.
It is.
And it's easier for you to get invested that way. I like, as soon as I lose track of like a plot, I start to check out, especially a really complicated one. I'm like, okay, the plot lost me. And then you always like kind of feel like it's your fault. Like, mm-hmm. oh, maybe I'm just a dumbass and I couldn't keep up with what's happening. But yeah, no. So I love that about this.
Should we talk about like the cinematography?
No, it's trash. I saw someone on Letterboxd said, give me an iPhone 12 and something else, I can make a better movie.
No, he's using every tool in the filmmaker's arsenal. He really is. Mm-hmm. Like, people say that all the time, but I think that he truly is.
One thing I really love about Kurosawa's films is the elements, too. Mm-hmm. And there's always a lot of wind and rain and mm-hmm. water and mud. Mm-hmm. And it's like he soaks in that stuff. For a filmmaker who is very sort of like action forward, of like always moving forward, and there's these big fight scenes, he's very much concerned with taking a break in the flowers or in the woods.
Flowers.
Or like fires that are lit along this path and just kind of like holding there for a second.
There's such a great shot where the one who's like a total badass, he's just sitting against a tree waiting for the bandit to come around the corner so he can kill him. Or the scene where he's practicing in the rain. Oh, amazing.
The scene where he's practicing in the rain was almost my favorite sight.
I love it.
But he does that stuff so well. Or like the windmill. It's not a windmill, it's a watermill. But yeah, like, it's all shot so beautifully. And again, it's all shot on location. Like, it doesn't look like sound stages. And it just has this earthy, all of his films kind of have this very like immediate earthy feel to them, which is so cool.
Yes. Tracking shots. This movie has amazing tracking shots.
Yeah. You know what else this movie has? An intermission.
It does indeed. It has a 5-minute intermission. I just want to, the one tracking shot I really love is when Shino's being chased out of her house. First of all, the reveal of her is fantastic. She's washing her hair. Someone has walked in. She doesn't know who. She turns around. Amazing. He's come to cut her hair, of course.
What a
her
dick.
Dad. Her dad is a dick. He really is. And then you get that beautiful shot of him chasing her. Another thing I think that this movie does really well, it cuts to wide in very specific places that are like super meaningful. The woman, the first time we see Kanbe and he's trying to save that kid, did you notice there's this beautiful wide shot? And I think it's the kid's mom. She like, he's asked for some rice balls and she gets the rice balls. She's on her way back to him, but then she kind of hesitates and she almost goes for her kid in the barn. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. It's like, it's also thought out because he is such an amazing editor. Right after the thief is killed, of course, it like cuts to wide and you see everyone running in different directions. Some like towards the thief, some towards him. Let's not forget Katsushiro and Shino when everyone leaves after she has been like shunned publicly by her dad. And then it like cuts to wide. It's raining. Slowly, people start leaving the frame. And it's just like, what?
He's there doing nothing, looking
doing
down,
nothing,
looking
being a pussy because that's what he does. And then, yeah, deep focus. This movie is like great at deep focus.
Mm-hmm.
The bowl of rice.
Mm-hmm.
Come on. Again, that scene. That scene's super powerful. It's like Shino's dad in the foreground and she's in the background like crying.
Yeah. He's a master for a reason.
It really? Yeah.
Yeah. Was this your first Kurosawa movie when you saw this? Really? Oh, okay. Okay. Which other ones have you seen?
Just Ikiru.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what's funny is Kurosawa made movies up through the 90s.
Really?
Yeah. And starting from like the 80s on, it's so crazy how this happens to like a legend like Kurosawa. But, you know, of course, he's revered among film circles, but he started having trouble getting his movies financed. So at a certain point in the 80s, people like George Lucas and Spielberg and Coppola would step up and like produce his movies.
Wow.
Because they weren't getting funded otherwise.
Were they good?
Yeah, that's like where Ron and Kagamusha came from. It was like produced by those guys. So yeah, like, or Dreams, where Scorsese plays Van Gogh. Yeah, it's just crazy how that happens to people. Like the Kurosawa at some point in his career, it's like Mike Lee right now. Right now, Mike Lee, according to an interview he did, cannot get funding for projects.
Wow.
It's like, this is Mike Lee. Like, what's the problem? Somebody shut up and write him a check.
Coppola's financing his next movie himself.
He is, yeah. Hmm. Yeah, Coppola hasn't really... I feel like his last few have either been financed by him or they've just been like, yeah...
Why are you laughing?
No, you know, because he hasn't made a big sort of studio movie in, I'd say, 20, 30 years, yeah. 25 years, something like that. Yeah. But yeah, so that's kind of, but Kurosawa, again, like such a huge influence on Western cinema, not the Western genre, but just Western, like US. Yeah. But like, you know, all those guys, the whole new Hollywood group, all of those guys, Scorsese, Coppola, Spielberg, they were all like, champions of Kurosawa's. And again, because he is this, he's a filmmaker for all audiences. Yeah. And he's a filmmaker regardless of like what you're into. Like I saw some people on Letterboxd like, this wasn't for me. I'm like, how is this not for you? Like it's a big rousing entertainment. It's escapism done really well with like really well-drawn characters and these great sort of quiet moments. But the spectacle is also handled really well. Like who is this not for? Show me. Tell me, raise your hand right now.
My mom.
Oh, really? Wait, did she watch this with you?
No, but she would never.
Oh.
It's not her thing.
Do you think if it was remade in English or something?
She doesn't like any action movie.
Oh, nothing?
No.
Really? Not a single one?
Mm-mm.
Here's the thing, though. This isn't an action movie in like the slick sense. Sometimes when I think action movie, I mean, this is sort of an action movie, but I think like a secret agent with a gun or something. Or I think like someone jumping out of airplanes. We're like, this is very grounded. This is very like relatable. Not relatable.
I mean, it's not. No, but that's our point. point, right? That's been our point the whole episode. It is kind of relatable.
Yeah, in terms of like, this is the struggle of the people, and they're doing, the action's not happening for someone to show off like their muscles or like a gun or something. It's showing off for these people to live, this village to continue living. And
yes.
So it's emotionally, you're emotionally invested in that stuff because that's where it comes from.
I don't want to bring it up again, but if you think about it, why is this so effective when like Marvel movies aren't, when they're doing the same thing? I mean, in Avengers, they're trying to save New York City.
No, I'll tell you why. Tell exactly. Me why. Because those movies are so convoluted.
No, of course. I agree with you. I'm just like, I want to put it into words somehow.
Well, let me say this too, okay?
Fake characters.
Fake characters?
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Like nothing, you don't really care about any of them.
Yeah.
Here's the thing, okay? Actually, I was reminded while I was watching this movie. Not that it's on the same level and not like I loved this movie, although I really, really liked it. But Top Gun Maverick has a very simple story. Mm-hmm. And again, in a very similar way to Seven Samurai. Again, it's nowhere near as good. I'm not, let me go on the record here. I'm not saying Top Gun Maverick is as good. But it's a simple story, and the film, every step of the way, is making sure you're on the same page as like what's going on. And so when that final mission happens, the final 30 to 40 minutes of Top Gun is really involving because you know exactly what they're supposed to do. They've been training for it the whole movie, just like this.
Definitely.
And again, it's a little cheese ball, but like those characters are, there's an attempt to like make them real people. Some of them.
It doesn't really work for me. I just remembered an action movie my mom likes.
Which one?
The Man from U.N.C.L.E.
Oh, the newer one with Army
Hammer?
Yes,
obsessed with Henry Cavill.
Oh, yeah.
But she loves it because it's like 60s and so chic and like...
Yeah.
I don't know. But like she would never sit down and watch like James Bond.
But that also is very chic and...
It's too plotty. It's too like thing for her. Too... Not chic enough. Here's the thing. Man from U.N.C.L.E., the main focus of the movie is really chicness.
Well, what about the Sean Connery Bond movies? Has she seen those?
I don't know if she's seen them.
Like Dr. No or Goldfinger, because those ones have very, very simple, like very streamlined plots, and they're very 60s and very like stylized.
Yeah, they're like actually
60s. Yeah, exactly.
I wonder.
Those ones,
try it with her.
I'd say those ones specifically, Dr. No and Goldfinger, yeah.
What about Slow-Mo?
It's used exactly like... It's very sparing, and when it's used to like great effect. You know what? I bet Sam Peckinpah really like.
Oh, of course.
I can see that as like that's the evolution of this. Although, again, he went in the wrong direction with it.
Of course,
we're not Peckinpah fans here.
The last shot, I love like the last part of this movie. The
I don't.
Whole far.
I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
The whole harvest scene, I love.
Yeah.
Because again, it's like tinged in like. Oh, they have, like, they're happy, the farmers, but, like, look how sad we are. And then it just, like, the camera tilts up to the graves. I didn't notice that the first time.
Mm-hmm.
It's all one shot. And then there's, like, the farm girls going in and out of frame and Shino, and it's just beautiful.
It's almost
I love it.
It's like the last shot of the previous movie we did, Nashville. Also, that tilt up.
Yeah.
At the end.
Look at this. We just can't stop with the references today.
Also, in this movie, they go to Disneyland.
Where in Disneyland?
You know, I don't think the end of this is so
grim. It's not.
No, it's not. And I don't think that they're necessarily sad at the end. The samurai, the remaining ones. Is there's what? There's three that
again,
remain
we
or
survive.
Four?
He says something like that, and then I mean, it ends. The last shot of the movie is the graves.
I mean, look what they did. You know.
Of course, no, of course, but then of course, like Katsushiro's still a wuss, and like I don't know.
Do you know? You're not a Star Trek fan at all, right?
No.
There's a saying that Spock has in Star Trek where he says, like, the need of the many outweighs the need of the one or the few.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, you know, seven samurai saved this entire village. And I think there's a sense of accomplishment and pride at the end of this, especially because this is such an ordeal to save this village. But no, I mean, yeah, it's sad because more than half of them die. But
I love the whole last scene. And then you get like this shot of like, of Shino like planting crop and she's singing, and it's very like, again, she's mysterious. She has like so many underlying emotions, I feel like. And
yeah,
it's just expressed in that song.
Yeah.
Cause like what is she thinking right then when she's working and she's singing and she's just passed by him for the last time? It's so good.
It's great.
Let's do Sight and Sound.
Let's do it.
What's your favorite site?
My favorite site. It's funny because I wrote like four down. Like I would write one down and then like another one would come back. Oh, wait, never mind. It's this. Oh, wait, never mind.
Can I just show you my piece of paper? These are all honorable mentions that I didn't even get to talk about.
I do want to say, okay, I'll very quickly mention my honorable mentions. Oh my God. The old man, the elder of the church sitting in front of the water mill waiting to die.
Yeah, the thing shot, right? Like that jump cut where it's just like boom, boom. And it's like him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like it cuts in.
Yeah.
Also that watery grotto that's right outside the bandit's lair, just because it's all these rocks with like waterfalls and it's very pleasing in an H2O sense. There's also the shot of Shino and whatever the guy's name is. Sitting Shiro. Right after he's just discovered that she's a woman.
Like, I love that shot. That was an honorable mention.
But my favorite has to go to Toshiro Mifune holding the crying baby outside the burning mill.
And he says, this baby is me.
Yeah, that's it for me.
Wow.
How about you?
Okay, mine. This was very hard because I have like a whole list of things I love. It's the scene where Shino and Katsushiro are in the meadow. And it's this arcing shot where like they're almost about to kiss, you know, and it like goes behind his head.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. When both times I've seen this movie, I rewind that shot after to just like marvel at it.
Nice.
It's amazing. It's one of those shots where you're like, wait, how is that physically possible? I just love it. Yeah. I know it's kind of lame to choose that out of all the like cool action-y shots, but
it's not.
What's your favorite sound?
My favorite sound, I'm realizing, takes place just about an hour into the movie, which is crazy because it's Mifune's kind of like proper introduction. Like we've seen him a couple times before this, but this is the first time he like comes to the samurai.
Yes, when he's like, drunk.
When he's drunk. It's actually just the music that plays as he's like drunkenly flailing around while he's like trying to prove himself. Here's a clip. Yeah, I just like that. First of all, crazy that it's not till like an hour into the movie that he really like enters the film.
Right.
It's just crazy. That first hour, it's just like this.
The first hour goes by super quick.
Yeah. What about you? What's your favorite sound?
My favorite sound is the sound of the children singing.
Oh, of course.
It's just so like, I don't know, provincial and lovely.
And which instance
provincial
is this?
In a good way.
What part did they sing?
It's like when they're training.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's just like, because I love when the samurai decide to like give their rice that they're being paid with to the kids. And I love their relationship with the kids. They like seem to be having fun with them. Kanbei's like carrying one at one point. It's just so sweet. It's part of what makes this movie so special.
Let's hear it right now.
Lovely.
Lovely.
What does our good friend Miss Kale have to say?
Pauline Kale. This is the segment where we read Pauline Kale's review of the film. In The Seven Samurai, the greatest battle epic since the birth of a nation of 1915, Akira Kurosawa achieves what modern American and European epic makers vainly attempt. The excitement of the senses.
I love it. Was this written in 54?
No, this was written in 1961.
Wow.
So 7 years after the film. It bears a resemblance to the Hollywood Western. The beauty of the Western genre is its formalization and stylization, the clarity and simplicity of the actions and motives. Although The Seven Samurai is brilliantly complex visually, and although it can be interpreted in terms of such complex themes as the problems of honor, the meaning of human cooperation, the interlaced responsibilities of defenders and defended, it preserves the chivalric simplicity of the Western plot, which is even more wonderful in the nuclear age. She says, there's a major weakness. When violence itself becomes the theme, when it is treated with such extraordinary range that we are caught up in what is literally an epic of action, we need protagonists commensurate with the pictorial grandeur. There is one, Kyozo, a swordsman who has no interest in life but the perfection of his swordsmanship. His early scenes in stills in slow motion, a fable of swordplay which must then become feudal sword death, are among the most beautiful in the film. But the principal characters are far more familiar, and at the creative level, familiarity should and must breed contempt.
Like, why does she have a problem with familiarity?
I don't know, because the whole movie is kind of
fascinating.
Yeah, she is.
I don't understand.
She also says, as the braggadocio link between the farmers and the samurai, Toshirô Mifune gives the movie much gusto, but he overplays. Like many other great ham, he calls too much attention to himself. No actor can do more with his knees and his behind than Mifune.
Oh my gosh.
But he also bares his teeth almost as often as Kirk Douglas.
Wow.
It is not merely that his defects as an actor jeopardize his spontaneity and uninhibited energy, but that his overacting exposes the cliches of the role, which is basically a comic turn. When the battle is over and the village is saved, one of the remaining samurai remarks, "Again, we survive." Kanbe corrects him, "Again, we lose. The winners are those farmers, not us. To have come so far for this." Raging, stampeding violence, scenes of slaughter and devastation that, as Tony Richardson remarked, are not unworthy of the Goya of Los Desastres. And then this little deep thought, which is not only highly questionable, but ludicrously inadequate. It's as if the epic makers didn't realize that what we have witnessed overpowers such flabby little thoughts, which bear a dismal resemblance to the humanistic thinking of message Westerns.
Oof.
Here is the problem of the men's action pictures. Either we get the ritual conflict of slick bad men versus strong silent heroes, i.e. evil pitted against good in a frame of reference too silly to take seriously, or we get the ritual conflict set in the commonplaces of a shopworn, socially conscious frame of reference which tries to give depth and meaning to the ritual and succeeds only in destroying its beautiful simplicity. The Seven Samurai, she does say, triumphs over these problems by pouring all its energies into the extremities of human experience, into conflict itself, but it looks for social truths beyond the action and provides an explicit content so banal that the epic beauties seem to be a virtuoso exercise. Perhaps Kurosawa, like his obsessive master swordsman, has no thoughts beyond the perfection of his craft. Action is all. The pity is that he doesn't seem to know that in The Seven Samurai, it is enough.
I don't agree with that. She's saying, like, it would have been okay if this was more stereotypical, which is like, why? She confuses the shit out of me.
Yeah, kind of a...
Like, I love her. She's just so harsh. I just don't get it. Like, I don't get her whole point about Kyozo. I don't understand this whole thing where, like, she has a problem with that last line. I think that's great. I think that this... I mean, again, I think that the substance in this movie is so rich and so wonderful because these characters are not so... Like, yes, okay, maybe they're a little stereotypical, but the point was that he didn't want them to be.
Like, she wants...
She wants them to be, almost.
Exactly. She wants a more straightforward...
Why?
Yeah. I don't know.
That confuses the hell out of me.
I know. Why wouldn't she want to... I don't know. It's one of the more baffling Pauline reviews we've read.
I think. And I love that we read the whole... Like, you read a lot of it because I just couldn't believe my ears. I think you, too, also couldn't believe your ears. And we were just like, more, more, more.
That was my first time reading it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Letterboxed?
Yeah. Hopefully, they'll be more kind.
Here's a 5-star review. It just says, too many sweaty ass cheeks. Five stars.
Oh my God, that was one of mine. Shit.
0.5 star. 207 minutes. All of them wasted. I genuinely feel like this is one of the worst movies I've ever seen.
Oh my gosh.
The abhorrent quality of the writing makes it horrible.
Oh.
Then take its subpar cinematography and depression-inducing acting, and you've got one of the worst movies ever made. Kurosawa wrote 7 unrelatable, unwatchable, one-note monstrosities of characters where none of them have a believable reason as to why they defend this village. The ending shot, shit, might just be my least favorite. The shot of the 7 samurai, 12 living, 5 not. What? The quote from Kanbei about how more is lost by indecision than by wrong decision makes absolutely no sense in this context, and I'm not sure why the filmmaker included it. One of the worst written movies, without a doubt.
It must have been opposite day when that person wrote
seriously.
No, because they made a point to bash like the specific things about it that are so good.
Yeah, I know. Maybe they're just trolling.
They've got to be.
Yeah.
1 star. I have the attention span of a 4-year-old. That's it.
2 stars. Boys be like, I know a place, and then make you watch this 4-hour movie and expect you to still bang them after.
1 star. I'm sorry, but this movie took me months to complete. LMAO.
Jesus Christ.
Oh my God.
That's bleak. Well, that's 7 Samurai.
That's such a good movie.
Yeah. Huh, the Pauline review kind of really left a little bit of a bad taste in my mouth.
Me too. This bitch.
Yeah.
Love her.
That's why we love her. It's funny because from that first paragraph, you're like, oh, this is the greatest epic since Birth of a Nation, which is a little telling too.
Right?
What are we doing next week? Next week, we're doing Casablanca.
Are you serious?
Michael Curtiz directs. So Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman. What's his name? Peter Lorre. Paul Heinrich.
Yeah, Paul Heinrich.
Yeah. This is like one of the most romantic movies ever made.
I'm so excited. I love this movie.
It's been a long time since I've seen
this. It's been a few years for me.
But I have like studied this several times like in school. So that's why I haven't watched it.
And I can't wait to talk about this next week. This movie, I love it. I really do love it. But it's just like, I can't believe how much it's
revered,
worshipped.
Yeah, I agree.
Like the fact that they make people study it and it is considered this like really perfect movie and is at the top of the AFI
list. I never thought
list.
That. Yeah,
I never thought that. Even though I do love it, it's a great movie.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm excited to discuss.
Yeah, so come back next week because we're doing Bogey.
Let's do it.
And Ingrid Bergman in Casablanca.
See, it's the kind of movie that makes me like. Oh, like I love it.
Yeah.
Like almost on par with like Harry and Sally. Like it's just a like nice romantic movie for me.
Yeah. With some wartime shenanigans going on.
Yeah. Ooh, I'm excited. Okay.
Yeah, so come back next week. We have a good show for you guys. But yeah, that'll wrap up this week. Until then, I'm Greg.
I'm Jackie.
Have a great week.
This has been an official podcast of the Arroyo Film Club. Seen and Heard is Jacqueline Pistagian and Greg Kleinschmidt. Theme music by Andrew Cox. You can find us at seenandheardpod.com.